Small Supports in Time of Crisis is a podcast series made using extracts from a live webinar which was recorded in July 2020 and hosted by Bill Love from NDTI, in conversation with Small Supports providers Doreen Kelly from Beyond Limits, Sam Smith from Sea Change, and Dave Barris from Positive Support for You. For some people using social care support, the pandemic has meant a loss or threatened loss of rights, well-being, and safety. But it doesn't have to be this way. This series explores how individually designed and led community-based supports have worked to protect both people's health and human rights.
Anyone who hasn't been working with us on what small supports are, it felt like it might be very useful to very quickly just give you five things that we think outline when we say small supports, this is what we collectively mean. It's not all services which happen to be small. So when we talk about collective small supports, what we collectively mean is that they've been developed around one person, they've been staffed around that person, that the funding is individualized, that small supports organizations on the whole think that they can grow by no more than five people a year. And small supports organisations probably, but there's lots of discussion about this, support no more than 20 to 30 people. So the key theme is they have been designed, grown and funded around the individual. And what prompted this conversation was that there's lots of discussion at the moment about COVID and keeping people safe. And as we've been talking to people in the small supports community, what we've noticed is that the design of small supports seems to have been much better about keeping people safe in challenging times, but also at the same time, increasing people's rights. So that's the thinking behind the conversation. We've got some questions which we've formulated from conversations to people. And the idea is that I'll put those questions to Dave, Doreen and Sam. But if anybody knows Dave, Doreen and Sam, the conversation will go wherever they choose to make it go, which is wonderful. And the first question I think I'd like to put is, how did you set up small supports in a way that was most likely to promote people's rights and safety? Doreen, do you want to jump into this conversation first? Sure. And then others sure. Jump in?
How I set up small supports in the first instance was as a response to what I thought was, mediocrity for people with disabilities. And it was based on some other work that a lot of people in Scotland at the time, and for those who don't know, I no longer live and work in Scotland. I live and work in the southwest of England, in Devon, Cornwall and Somerset. But in those days, there was a few people in Scotland really starting to think, gosh, these group homes, these core and cluster, these places that are designed around organisational needs rather than people's needs, weren't terribly effective. And my own experience was an example of that might have been something like helping five or six people move into a house together. This was pre this work, with four or five or six other people who all had the labels of having challenging behaviour. And I suppose, truth be told, all hell let loose. And when I sat back and reflected, I thought, well, of course, all hell's going to let loose. So some of those things and experience, I mean, I say this thing, and what I say is that if you listen to the people who get support, they'll tell you how to do your job. And that was a very prime example of me being told how to do my job better in those early days. That was not possible to do in the organisation I worked in. So I got to the point where I decided to set up my own organisation. And at this point, it was in Scotland. That organisation was called Partners for Inclusion. And that was in 1998 when I started doing that. So, and some of the things that, so some of the learning for me and some of the reasons that six-person house for people that were labelled with challenging behaviour, who were leaving a local mental health hospital. Some of the things that I think were drastically wrong were we didn't see people in a funny way. We were innately institutionalised and innately discriminatory. So people didn't have their own homes, people didn't have their own staff, people didn't do the things that they wanted necessarily to do with their time. So we started thinking about how to get people their own homes, how to get people their own staff, how to think about money. And there was a load of work going on in Scotland at the time, and you know, some of the people around at the time were folk like Simon Duffy, Peter Kinsella, a guy called Pete Ritchie in Scotland, and you know, folk like Sam and myself and Francis. There was a few of us kind of doing some learning jointly with all of these people. So we got to the point where we thought, okay, an organisation that respects people's human rights is probably going to at least respect one of people's rights, which is to have a home of your own. It's probably going to respect another right, which is to have a decent family life. It's probably going to respect another part of their life, which is to choose who supports you and choose who's in your life on an intimate sometimes, and if not intimate, a daily basis. And also we thought that a good way to do that was to think about the money as if the money was really the person paying us rather than the state or a large organisation. So that's where we came across the idea of, I mean, this wasn't me, this was this group of people, and in particular people like Simon, coming across this idea that maybe we should have things called individual service funds, so as money could be used to wrap a service around a person and to protect their human rights. So that's kind of where I began. I'll stop at that and I'll let other people jump in on that.
Kicking off on the rights, on establishing services that support people's rights. Sam, does that resonate for you?
I was a commissioner involved in the closure of the long stay hospitals. And it was so abundantly clear, particularly around those people who are good at customer feedback, people who have these reputations, that people were returning to the hospital not because of anything they'd done. All of it was really predictable, but because the supports around them kind of worked on the premise that you conform or you leave. You know, if you're too tricky, you go back. There is a place for you to go back to, and that's where you go. And then so that the idea of having that fundamental that supported living as articulated by Kinsella was about the separation of housing and support. And that meant if your support was not working for you because they thought you should go somewhere else, that you stayed there and your support changed if that's what was needed. And that's about your fundamental rights to right to home and family life. So just really beginning to think that instead of trying to fix and support the person, we still have the long shadow of the medical model, you know, overlaying an awful lot of what still happens now. The idea that you had to kind of, the a successful service is where someone was quiet, where they were managed and controlled, rather than somewhere where that there was the flexibility to be able to develop as the person changed and developed. Now, if you've been in hospital for 30 years, you actually at that point don't really know who you are. And so the idea of commissioning in that traditional model of you fix the hours, fix the outcomes at that point seemed to make no sense. It did not allow for human flourishing, and actually was not cost effective. So to me it seemed just to make sense that we focused on the person, focused on their rights, focused on how to ensure that they felt safe and happy and were supported by people who wanted to be in their life. And in doing that, then people only require the level of support that they want and need.
Dave, can I bring you in there and ask you to pick up on? So we've reflected on establishing things in a way that supports people's rights. Now, in a pre-COVID world, how does establishing supports in that way promote people to be safe?
I think it's I'm very much following on from colleagues, and in fact, my story is people might be aware that. I mean, it's exactly 10 years since our organisation started. And I left local authority land as my former life as a commissioner and manager, and I follow, very much followed Dorian at that time. Dorian, you were in Scotland, and I came to Kilmarnock to see the work you were doing. So I'm certainly following that path, really. I mean, our story was in Teesside. The work that we were doing from the outset was born out of good commissioning. So I think that's always worth reiterating, because that's quite important. And we're talking about people who, for whatever reason, could be described as being uncompromising, either themselves, their needs are uncompromising, or the legends that grew up about people, and the commissioners across a number of authorities in Teesside wanted to see an organisation like the organisation that Dorian had in Kilmarnock operating in Teesside. And we've always strived to try and emulate the work that was being done up there and now in Plymouth and with Sam's organisation in Scotland as well. And to do that with people with big reputations, with people with forensic labels, who were exactly as you were saying, Sam, you know, with predictable behaviours that they displayed, throughout their lives or for many years, but services were failing them, and placements were failing them, and the services that were being arranged and commissioned for people were failing them. So the revolving door was well in operation. People were back in assessment and treatment beds, and there was at least recognition amongst commissioners there that something different needed to be done, and that was where we were born, really, in terms of trying to provide at least part of that solution. So in terms of answering the question, Bill, just simply by making that step change of saying, well, let's stop doing what we've been doing wrong, because it obviously is going wrong. If somebody's been in hospital five times in 3 years and three different placements in the last 2 years and all these sorts of stories we were hearing, and stop doing that and do something differently and start building out from the person, just by putting people in. I think the housing decision is absolutely key. I think, by definition, as a statement of principle, if someone's in their own house, in their own tenancy, that's them having some control over who they live with. That's having some rights and some responsibilities about the space that they occupy, you know, and that they're big statements on both sides. And also then by recognising that people aren't always going to get on with other people that they're matched with, in inverted commas, and those sorts of things, that people have some real opportunity to have the space that they need and choose. From there, it's about recognizing the support people need. They need people that they can relate to and trust and build a relationship with. And for people with big reputations and who've had histories of doing sometimes quite unpleasant things, in some cases, let's be brutally honest, and also indulging in behaviours which have put themselves at some significant risk as well, in certain cases, then it's important that we get the right people who are going to have that relationship and trust and work with the person, and be able to do that. So trying to find staff who are able to match into person-centred plan and service design, you know, and taking it out from there. I think that you're making clear steps from the outset, which say it's not about compromising. It's about actually listening to the person and actually building a service that's really person-centered, and not sticking them into the vacant bed in the five-person home, because you know what happens when that's done incorrectly, and it's just, you know, not right. It's not right to do that.
I'm mindful when you talk about putting people in a vacancy, is that one of the first conversations we had about this was there was a collective agreement that the minute we place somebody, we've started failing them. But from what you've just said, so I've picked up five key things about safety, and that's about creating safety by people having the space that's their own and that they control, mm-hmm. and that people are safe by having support that's their own and they control. And safety through thinking about the expectation and challenges that are placed on other people. Safety by having understanding and honesty about people's behaviours, mm-hmm. their people's previous history and what that means for the future. And I think that you also there talked about safety we often don't talk about, which is safe from the failures of others.
Thank you for listening. For more information about NDTI's Small Supports Programme, follow the link in the podcast description or visit ndti.org.uk.